Good afternoon, and welcome to the Eco-News Report. I'm your host this week, Scott Greeson, director of Friends of the Eel River. The Eco-News Report is an exclusive feature of KHSU brought to you by the North Coast Environmental Center, publisher of our regional environmental newspaper, the Eco-News. Don't forget, you can find this show and other KHSU public affairs shows on the audio archives page at khsu.org. In kind of a twist today, I'm going to be the guest, actually, and Alicia Heyman, Friends of the Eel River's administrative director, is going to be asking me some questions. So, on this week's Eco-News Report, we're going to be talking about three different subjects that all bear on the future of the Eel River and her fisheries. The first is a major new report from California Trout and the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences that really highlights both the threats to salmonids across the state of California and the potential for conservation results in the North Coast, and especially in places like the Eel River. We're also going to be talking briefly about the process that's just started that would relicense the Eel River dams on the upper Mainstem River, and also spend a little time talking about the status of the lawsuit which Friends of the Eel River brought challenging the North Coast Railroad Authority's refusal to follow California environmental law in rebuilding a railroad along the Eel River Canyon.
So, California Trout and the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences have just produced this new review of the status of California salmon, steelhead, and trout. Based on a report from the UC Davis team led by Dr. Peter Moyle, who's widely recognized as the leading expert on California fisheries. What does this State of the Salmonids review tell us?
Well, let's remember that salmonids is a general word for salmon and trout. So
right.
It means coho and chinook salmon, steelhead trout, but also the coastal cutthroat trout and the rainbow trout that are, in fact, very closely related to the steelhead. They're the inland form of the steelhead trout. But the big news is that after the first version of this report in 2008 told us that salmon in California face dire threats, is that many of those threats have gotten a good deal worse. And a lot of this is down to the 4 years of extreme drought we had from 2012 to 2016. But really, the bottom line is if we don't make some pretty significant changes to how we manage our watersheds and how we impact our watersheds, we're likely to lose more than half of our anadromous sea run fish in the next 50 years, 11 of the 21 species left in California, a third of inland species of the trout. And within the next century, the report projects that we're likely to lose 3/4 of the remaining 31 species.
Wow. So there's 32 distinct species in California, but that's more than state or federal agencies recognize.
Right. We should say that in this report, they look at 32 species. One's actually already extinct. That's the bull trout, the largest form of the trout that we used to have in California. Now, those bull trout are still hanging on in the Rockies. They're not extinct in the United States, but they're gone from California. But one of the good things about this report is that the scientists are looking at the best available science about what runs actually exist. And that's a little different from the standards that state and federal wildlife agencies have used to determine what runs exist and should be protected. And because of the politics around species protection, the fact is, as the report says, quote, current lists of threatened and endangered species do not reflect the true conditions of all salmonids in California. We don't list, we don't recognize some of the most critically imperiled fish in our watershed and in the North Coast watersheds. Summer steelhead in the Eel River are not recognized as a distinct species. Spring run chinook in the Klamath River are not recognized as a distinct species. And so they're not evaluated in the way that they need to be if we're going to protect them. We're not actually paying attention to them. We're not monitoring them very well because we don't recognize them separately.
So why is it important to monitor salmonids?
Well, there are a lot of good reasons. Probably the biggest and most obvious in terms of human society is that salmon are the most valuable fish in our rivers.
Mm.
They're economically, ecologically, and culturally incredibly significant fish. And we could spend days talking about the importance of salmon to cultures. The great book Totem Salmon explores that, you know, in the context of the Matol and the restoration culture that people created here. But there are broader scientific benefits used to looking at salmon. It's kind of like looking at the northern spotted owl as a proxy for the health of species throughout the old forest that the owl depends on. It helps you get sort of a sense of that whole system using that species as an umbrella. Similarly, salmon can really be a kind of umbrella species for basically aquatic conservation, river conservation. If we can protect salmon, then we're probably protecting most other things. Another big reason, though, is that salmon are exceptionally vulnerable to climate change, to the rising temperatures, and to the declining stream flows that we're likely to see as the climate continues to warm and weather responds to it. And the eel is unfortunately a pretty good example of this. Really, we have good, solid, long-term data from the eel from the dams on the upper main stem, from the Van Arsdale fish ladder, and not from really anywhere else. That's because we haven't spent the money to set up the kind of monitoring we could and should have in the Eel River.
So we talked about the spring run Chinook and the Klamath and the summer steelhead and the eel. What other salmon species are most imperiled?
First, let's take a step back and talk a little bit about how they do these evaluations, because there's a real problem in this kind of science of making apples to apples comparisons. How do you talk about how threatened golden trout are in the High Sierra compared to coho salmon on the North Coast? Mm. They're in pretty different situations. The problems that coho salmon face may not be the same ones that the golden trout face. So how do you make a useful comparison of these things? And what the team did was try to look at the key factors for each of these runs, each of these species, including their population numbers, the trends in those population numbers, their habitat conditions, and what the nature and extent of the key threats are for each of those species. They also tried to include a term for how confident they are in these assessments. And then they give a score to each of these between 1 and 4, and then they average them out and basically came out with a score between 0 and 4 for each of these runs, and then ranked them on how they came out on that. So a score between 1 and 2 is critically imperiled. A score below 1 is extinct. That's the bull trout. But we came out with some pretty bad scores for some of the most critically imperiled fish in California. Those include the Central Coast coho salmon, the silver salmon from just south of us in the Russian River South, which got a 1.3, and the Sacramento River winter run Chinook, which is a species that really depends on cold water in the upper Sacramento, which it hasn't had in the last 4 years of drought, also got a 1.3. So they're just in really bad shape. But the spring Chinook in the upper Klamath got a 1.6, which is not much better. And, you know, those are not promising numbers. They're pretty scary.
What about in the eel?
Well, the good news, sort of, is that our Chinook salmon, the fall run Chinook, got a 3.1, which qualifies as only a moderate risk of extinction. So one thing to think about there is if our Eel River Chinook, which have declined to, you know, at best a single digit percentage of their former abundance. This is a river that produced 1 million fish in a good year, 500,000 fish in even a bad year. If it's producing a few thousand Chinook salmon in a year, that's 3% of its former abundance. We're looking at a fishery that is in that very, very low status in terms of its population returns. It's just suffered really badly from the drought. We know that. We know, looking at the Klamath River and their very low returns and the fact that fishing's had to be canceled entirely in the Klamath and offshore here, that we're not doing very well. And yet those fish are rated as moderate.
Is that a reflection of the baseline we're using?
Kind of. I mean, and there's this problem of shifting baselines that, you know, if we go back 50 years or 100 years, we would have experienced some of that abundance. And we would now be saying, well, what happened to the fish? But we're used to having not very many fish. And so when a few more started to come back, that looked pretty good. Like, hey, we've doubled the returns from the late 80s. So that was looking good. But part of the picture, though, is that in the Klamath, in the Trinity, and in many of the other large rivers up and down the West Coast, Sacramento, Rogue, Columbia, Columbia, most of the salmon that come out of the river and are caught by commercial fishermen are hatchery fish. And we don't actually have any hatcheries left in the Eel. We had some small hatcheries operating for a while, but we don't now. And so you run into a lot of problems figuring out how many wild fish there are when you've got hatcheries producing a lot of fish that tend to mask the state of the wild fish. So in some ways, again, that means the Eel's in worse shape because we don't have so many hatchery fish. But in other ways, it means we actually have the fish we have. And so it doesn't look great, but at least they're all wild fish. At least they're all capable of perpetuating themselves. But again, the Chinook are the good news. The coastal cutthroat trout that I mentioned, the Eel is the southern limit of this fish's range on the West Coast. They get a 2.7. That's a high risk of extinction. That's not great, but it's not terrible. But our coho salmon in the Eel River and in this whole region from the Rogue River to the Eel and the Mattole are rated as 1.7. A critical risk of extinction. That's really, really bad news. And I'm pretty sure this report comes before the recent survey information we've seen from the California Department of Fish and Wildlife, which in the Eel showed that our coho are only showing up in, again, a single-digit proportion of their known habitat. Less than 10% of the coho habitat in the Eel is getting used right now because there aren't very many fish. And that's a consequence both of the drought impacts and of the human impacts that have come on top of that drought, especially in the Green Rush. The picture for steelhead, as we said, is a little complicated in the Eel because the federal government only recognizes a single combined run of winter and summer steelhead. But Moyle and Company in the SOS report look at winter steelhead in the Eel and say they've got a moderate risk of extinction. But our summer steelhead get a 1.9. Again, they're at a critical risk of extinction. We're talking here about two small populations that we know about in the Middle Fork Eel and the Van Dusen, the Upper Van Dusen. Populations of adults that come back, which number, in the case of the Van Dusen, dozens to a few hundred. In the case of the Middle Fork population, hundreds to maybe 1,000 adults. This is one of the places where if we could remove the upper basin dams on the main stem Eel and reopen more than 250 miles of stream habitat, that would really help those summer steelhead, which are fish that come into the river in the summer, need to find a cold place to hang out, and then in the fall and winter, go further up the drainage and spawn in the tops of the drainage. So they're really exceptional fish. They're large fish. They're clearly unique to the Eel, but they're not even recognized under the federal ESA at this point. And we'll be fighting as soon as we get the science out on this to try to get those fish recognized. But we have to understand at the same time that the whole federal mechanism of species protection is really under siege. It's a real threat. And the Republican Party would like nothing more than to do away with the Endangered Species Act or gut it. So we're trying to improve things, but at the same time, kind of our mechanisms for protection are at real risk of being taken away.
So, trying to be hopeful, what does this report say we can do to protect these species and to ensure that they're not lost in the next 50 to 100 years?
Well, the scientists really emphasize the need to protect the key habitats we still have and restore ecosystem protections where possible. And this is a by now familiar idea. Protect the best, restore the rest as a strategy for maintaining landscapes where endangered species can survive. On the Eel, that means removing the dams on the upper main stem, as we mentioned, especially for the steelhead, by restoring estuarine functions like the Salt River Project is doing on the lower Eel. These are really important because those are parts of the habitat that serve the parts of the salmon life cycle that are critical to getting more fish out to the ocean and back successfully, which is how you get more fish. You know, you need more fish coming back in order to make more babies. You need good habitat to raise the babies, and you need the estuary to feed them up and get them fat before they go to the ocean. So there's a lot of opportunities in the Eel to improve things. But the other thing we have in the Eel that we need to recognize is the potential for refugia that already exists, that we have a place that's relatively undeveloped, even though it's almost 90% privately owned. It's close to the coast and likely to be cooler and damper and have better flows than places up in the Sierras. And in fact, this idea of the eel as a refuge for steelhead and other salmon is not a new one. It's one that was proposed in the 1920s and 30s by Leo Shapovalov, one of the early steelhead researchers and founders of what was then the Department of Fish and Game's fisheries program.
Wow. So people can see this State of the Salmonids report for themselves at caltrout.org. And you'll also see a link for that if you're listening on a podcast in the description there.
We should mention now and again that you're listening to KHSU, the Eco News Report. I'm Scott Greeson, Director of Friends of the Eel River, in the studio with Alicia Heyman, also with Friends of the Eel River. And we're talking about the State of the Salmon report that's just been issued by the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences and California Trout, as well as some of the other events happening, which may have real import for the future of Eel River fisheries.
What's going on with the Eel River dam relicensing?
Well, as those who've been paying attention know, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the federal agency responsible for licensing hydroelectric projects like the two dams on the Upper Mainstem Eel, has just reopened the relicensing process for the Cape Horn and Scott dams and the tunnel that takes water over to the Potter Valley. Now, they call it the Potter Valley Project, but we're going to call it the Eel River Dams because that helps people understand where they are. The big picture here is that FERC, this agency, plans to issue another 50-year operating license for these two dams and that diversion tunnel. Our big hope, frankly, is that the agency will instead direct that the dams be decommissioned and dismantled, taken out. It's time to take those dams out and, as I was saying earlier, restore more than 250 stream miles of key habitat above the dams. But this process doesn't automatically go there. It is yet indispensable. It's really important that we participate in this because this is the framework within which we could actually see dam removal happen. And ultimately, we can't get dam removal without FERC signing off on it. And you see that, in fact, in the Klamath Dam removal deal, where whether it went through Congress, which they tried and didn't succeed with, or goes through a private deal between the states and Pacific Power, they still need to get FERC to sign off on dam removal, which FERC is expected to do shortly in the case of the Klamath dams. But what we're hoping to do in this process is highlight the threats to Eel River fish that the dams present, the problems of dam safety that we see in these dams, and the reasons to look at dam removal as opposed to operating these obsolete, unsafe, and probably not very cost-effective dams for another 50 years.
We talk internally about a formal and an informal process. The FERC process is part of this formal avenue. What other kind of work do we have to do?
Well, you know, the problem is partly that we need people to understand the limits of the FERC process. And part of that is, as I was saying, that FERC is a power promotion agency. They're not really interested in telling dam owners not, you know, to take their dams out. The other problem, and this is a really big one, is that FERC has decided that it doesn't want to address questions of dam safety in its relicensing process. Their position is that the agency has a separate part that looks at dam safety. And they sort of seem to assume that if they're going to license something, then it's safe, period.
Well, I think the Orville crisis revealed some shortcomings in that process.
Yeah. And for those who've been hiding under a rock or just returned to Earth after a brief sojourn on the moon, you know, we almost lost the Oroville Dam, one of the largest dams in the continental U.S. 180,000 people had to evacuate from below the dam because the folks who built and maintained the dam, one, hadn't inspected it adequately, and two, probably hadn't built it well enough to resist the impacts of very high flows. And again, with climate change, we are looking at the likelihood of greater flows in many of our rivers than we had anticipated in the 20th century. But the fundamental problem with the Oroville Dam was they weren't prepared for the kind of threat they had. And First, their spillway failed from probably a combination of bad construction and not adequate inspection. And then their emergency spillway wasn't actually able to do the job it was supposed to do. And as observers have noted, the environmental groups who monitor these things had pointed out exactly these problems 10 years ago, 15 years ago, during the relicensing process. They hadn't called for the dams to come out. They just said, you need to deal with these safety problems, which were real. Unfortunately, the state of California, which owns those dams, and the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission have both failed to look at those issues. They failed to take them seriously. And here's the real kicker. They've actually made it impossible for citizens, for groups like ours, and even for legislators to know what the problems are. There's this whole category of information which the dam owners need to have, which dam regulators need to look at, and which an informed citizenry should be able to look at, which tells us about what the vulnerabilities of these structures are and what the potential is for them to fail and what the results and consequences could be if they were to fail. And if we could look at that information for Oroville, we would understand better how the spillway failed, why the emergency spillway wasn't built right, what the risks of real failure for the whole structure would be. Unfortunately, all that stuff is classified as what's called confidential energy infrastructure information under the Patriot Act, which was passed following the 9/11 attacks. And basically what this category, CEII, means is it has to do with dam safety, and so it's secret, and we're not going to reveal it to the public. The only way you can find out about this stuff is to sign a non-disclosure agreement, which then prevents you from discussing it with anyone else. And this is a big problem, and we've been saying it's a big problem for a while, but now people can see with Oroville what we mean by a big problem. And it's not just the Eel River dams we have to talk about here. People are talking about the potential for problems at the Trinity Dam, the potential for problems at the San Luis Dam, which is one of the major water storage projects in the Central Valley. If we see earthquakes on these sites, we're going to see real problems. And that's one of the big problems we have with the Eel River dams, is that the Scott Dam, the upper dam, is built right on top of a fault. We didn't know about it when we built the dams. We didn't have plate tectonics figured out in the 19-teens.
Yeah,
well, it was a century ago. Yeah. But we've learned a lot. One of the things we've learned is that a lot of the places we like to build dams are where rivers cross faults and their canyons get narrow.
It's the most natural place for a dam, apparently.
Yeah.
So another big issue that we're engaged with on the river is our hearing before the California Supreme Court trying to protect the river from a railroad being rebuilt without thorough environmental review.
Yeah.
On May 3rd, you and I both had the privilege of being in the California Supreme Court's San Francisco hearing chamber as the seven justices of the highest court considered the cases that Friends of the Eel River and Californians for Alternatives to Toxics brought, challenging the North Coast Railroad Authority's refusal to follow California environmental law in rebuilding that failed rail line. What did you take away from the hearing?
Well, some cautious optimism, which is nice given that it's been 6 years since we filed the case and we've had a series of pretty tough challenges to get to the California Supreme Court. We had a pretty serious reversal before the Court of Appeals where it was clear that the court just didn't get what we were talking about and wasn't interested. But in this hearing, it was pretty clear that the justices understood our case. And I think one of the most revealing moments was when the Chief Justice herself, Kentil Sekuye, I hope I said her name right, actually asked a question about something that wasn't even in our briefs. She asked the railroad's lawyer about a consent decree they'd reached with the city of Novato in a CEQA case, a California Environmental Quality Act case, just before ours started, in which the railroad agreed with the city that they would prepare an environmental impact report. Now, again, that wasn't in our briefs. Somebody was reading the record there.
She'd clearly done some research.
Yeah, either she or her law clerks understood, you know, the factual foundation of this case. That's not a good sign for the railroad. The other thing that you can say is that looking at how the judges interacted with the attorneys, they treated our attorneys a little differently than they treated the railroad attorney. And as you mentioned, Californians for Alternatives to Toxics, CATS, and Friends of the Eel River brought two separate cases. So when we came up before the Supreme Court, we each had an attorney arguing our case. For CATS, it was Helen Kong of the Golden Gate Clinic, who's an extremely distinguished attorney and professor of law. For Friends of the Eel River, it was Amy Bricker from Shoot Mahaly Weinberger, which is a very capable CEQA firm, one of the best in California. And the court asked six questions of Helen Kong and only five of Amy Bricker. They weren't particularly difficult questions. They were probing questions, but they didn't sort of refuse to accept the premise of our attorney's arguments. On the other side, Andrew Sabe from the law firm Cox Castle was representing both the North Coast Railroad Authority, the public agency we're suing, and the private company that holds the lease that they paid a dollar for 100 years, the Northwest Pacific Company. So this is really the private tail wagging the public dog in this whole thing, just as an aside. And so Andrew Sabe's really there representing former Congressman Doug Bosco, who's there in the courtroom and who is both a key shareholder in the Northwest Pacific Company and the longtime boss of the executive director of the North Coast Railroad Authority, Mitch Stagner, who was Bosco's chief of staff for many, many years. So Andrew Sabe, the railroad lawyer, got 16 questions to our combined 11, and they were pretty tough questions. The first question Sabe got was from Godwin Liu. Now, Justice Liu didn't question Kong or Bricker at all, but he's really the guy that savvy observers of the California Supreme Court look to kind of crystallize the court's position. And he clearly wasn't buying Sabe's version of this case. You know, Sabe got pretty upset, I think it's fair to say, at the questioning he was getting. He ultimately wound up describing CEQA, which is California's law that requires us to look at the impacts of our projects before we undertake them, as a tool of oppression, an instrument of guerrilla warfare. And he must have repeated four or five times this central claim he has, which is clearly what they're looking to base an appeal on, that CEQA is the quintessential example of a statute requiring what he called open-ended environmental preclearance, and thus is categorically preempted by federal railroad law. Now, that's the central question in our case, but, you know, we're pretty sure their version of this is not compelling. And in fact, nobody on the bench seemed to take the bait on that argument.
If you guys want to see this for yourselves, there's a video available now that's up on our website at eelriver.org. It is really fascinating to watch the interactions between the justices and the attorneys and how they differed from our side to the railroad side.
And we should say that unlike federal courts, because Jerry Brown won't let judges in California get paid until they issue their opinions, we're looking at an opinion issuing in this case no later than mid-July, but quite possibly in the first couple of weeks of July. And we'll update you, of course, once that comes out. But we do want to caution that there is a real prospect that the railroad company, if they lose, as could happen here, will appeal the case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's not a place environmental lawsuits want to go.
Well, let's hope for the best. If you want to be involved in this, a good way is to sign up for our newsletter so that you're always up to date on what's going on. And, you know, really, it's a hard thing to ask for, but we need your financial support. These are expensive lawsuits, and we've got a lot of really tough work ahead of us, particularly with dam removal.
And we've got to get study plans in by early August that basically need to lay out all of the issues we want to raise for what's going to be at least 5 years of a relicensing process and could be as long as 20. So it's really important for us to get that work done this summer. So if you can help us, we'd appreciate it. Thanks. This has been the EcoNews Report. My name's Scott Greason. I've been your semi-host for the past half hour, speaking with Alicia Heyman, also from Friends of the Eel River. If you have any questions or comments about this program, please call our listener comment line at 826-6089. You can hear this broadcast again on the archive programs page of the station's website at khsu.org. The Eco News Report is produced at Humboldt State University in cooperation with the North Coast Environmental Center. Many thanks to Fred McLaughlin for his engineering. Tune in again next week at this same time for the Eco News Report.